This evening, dear brothers and sisters, we are to have an address by our brother Alan Wharton entitled Character Study, Moses, the Meekest of Men. And then to introduce that chapter, he has asked that we read together Numbers chapter 12. And so, with that introduction, invite our brother Alan Wharton to speak to us on Moses, the meekest of men.
Well, good evening, brethren and sisters. That chapter that we have just read together with Brother Paul, of course, contains the description of meekness as it is applied to Moses. And it's a statement in brackets in the middle of a chapter telling us why he was challenging or being challenged for marrying that Ethiopian woman and God's response to that challenge. Because God took up the cause on behalf of Moses and gives us that further comment in verse 7, which is almost as familiar to us as an idea as the one about meekness. So if we can just have a look again at that 12th chapter of Numbers in verse 7. God says, "My servant Moses is not so, who is faithful in all mine house." And we're familiar, of course, with the concept that vengeance belongs to God. And if we ever needed an example of how that applies, then this must be it. Moses, being a meek man, did not need to do what he would once perhaps have been tempted to do, because God stepped in and smote Miriam with leprosy, which in the Bible, of course, is symbolic of sin. So Moses' meekness was legendary. Therefore, what does it mean? If we take the original word and see what it is translated as in other places, we find words such as humble, lowly, and mild. And we might add our own description, which is self-effacing. And in my Bible, there is a cross-reference in against that verse to Psalm 76, and I think it might be just useful to look at that psalm. It's not the only psalm where this word is translated in another way, but this one I think is quite appropriate. It's Psalm 76. And it gives us a very clear idea of what the Spirit intends us to understand from this word that's translated as meek. So reading from verse 7 of Psalm 76 down to the end. Speaking to God, "Thou, even thou, art to be feared, and who may stand in thy sight when once thou art angry? Thou didst cause judgment to be heard from heaven, the earth feared and was still. When God arose to judgment to save all the meek of the earth. Surely the wrath of man shall praise thee, the remainder of wrath shalt thou restrain. Vow and pay unto the Lord your God. Let all that be round about him bring presents unto him that ought to be feared. He shall cut off the spirit of princes. He is terrible to the kings of the earth." And in a way, that passage from Psalm 76 could be regarded as a commentary on the event that we read about in Numbers chapter 12. How God arose to judgment to save the meek. But also, one of the points that comes out of this is that meekness is not shyness or simple self-effacement as a personal characteristic, a natural personal characteristic, but something rather that has to be developed as a specific character, a deliberate attempt to change to that character. Something that has to be done in order to become pleasing to God. Meekness is contrasted with pride and self-will, which is much more common natural characteristic. But the original word translated meek here is not a common word even in the Bible. And the Psalms actually have about half of those words, all of them with a very similar application. And from those passages, we discover that the meek, however we might then define that, and we will come back to this, the meek will be guided in judgment, they will be taught God's way, and ultimately they will receive joy and salvation. And all of that is, of course, entirely consistent with what we find in the New Testament. First of all, we have the words of Jesus. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And Jesus also applied it to himself, but with reference to the fact that his meekness had huge benefits for his followers, just as Moses had huge benefit for the Israelites. Perhaps we can turn to Matthew chapter 11 and verse 28. A very well-known passage, as in fact all of these passages are well-known to us. Matthew chapter 11, verse 28. Come unto me, all ye that labour and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. But by far the most references in the New Testament are where the apostles urged this quality upon the early believers. And we find this word in no less than 10 of the epistles. Meekness is, of course, one of those fruits of the Spirit that we read about in Galatians chapter 5. And again, perhaps we can quickly look at that, Galatians chapter 5. And verse 22. Galatians chapter 5, verse 22. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. And they that are Christ's have crucified the flesh with the affections and lusts. If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. Let us not be desirous of vain glory, provoking one another, envying one another. The original Greek word here actually means controlled strength. It certainly doesn't mean timidity. And according to William Barclay, in his book on New Testament words, as quoted by a brother Colin Attridge in his book, The Fruit of the Spirit, the classical Greek also means gentle, mild, and gracious. And we, brethren and sisters, have to develop all these qualities. They stand or fall together. Paul said here that there is no law that can stand against them. And that's an interesting comment, I think, given Paul's former misplaced zeal for the law that Moses gave. Meekness is a work of the Spirit, the opposite of vainglory. And Brother Colin in his book reminds us that God himself is actually the greatest example of meekness. Because if his strength was not controlled and not tempered with grace and gentleness, then none of us would survive. To be biblically meek, we must understand that we cannot act in our own strength or try to do so. We need to be able to rely on God for everything. Perhaps rather we should acknowledge that God is behind everything we do if we are serving him, and we trust that he will guide us in what we do. If we develop biblical meekness, then we shall no longer fall into the human trap of having to impress others or rely on self-confidence. We become co-workers with God, and that also means accepting the outcome that he decrees. Now, before we return to Moses in the Old Testament, we just want to complete our review of what the New Testament says about Moses and his character by turning to Hebrews 11. This is obviously a chapter that talks about faith, but nevertheless, it gives us a comment on the personal qualities, the character of Moses, rather than in his role as a lawgiver or in a doctrinal capacity. This is a personal comment on him. So Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 24. By faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. From this it is plain that Moses had no expectation of present material riches. He saw those things as a distraction from the real purpose of his life. Now, all God's children do look forward to a time when there will be abundant riches. But if Egypt was rich, then the kingdom of God will be far richer. And that is where Moses wants to be. And if Moses was commended for being meek in personal character, as biblically defined, then it is also clear that this was not a question of him being weak and spineless. The man had strength of character. He wasn't insipid. There was a core of steel in him. And that brings us to the point of the study for ourselves. Because in fact, to form that character, Moses had to change in order to become truly meek in God's eyes. So in order to keep this subject fairly simple, perhaps we can bear in mind four separate aspects to this character that Moses developed. First of all, he was reticent when first called to perform the mission that God intended for him, to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt. He didn't feel up to the task, and we'll come back to that in a minute. Secondly, he had great faith despite adversity, and that's the assessment we have in this chapter in Hebrews 11. Thirdly, he had patience, and again, this was something he had to learn. And fourthly, finally, he developed a completely unselfish character when fulfilling the commission that God had appointed him for. He displayed completely the quality described in Galatians, not desirous of vainglory, or provoking other people, or envying other people. He was prepared for his own name to be blotted out of God's book in order that others could go forward. He did this because he knew God's will was to take the people into the land, and he was prepared to be sacrificed for that cause. Now, the point of this study is to give ourselves the opportunity to see how we might compare to his example. Take a moment as we proceed to review your own progress, as I must do as well. Review our progress against these aspects of meekness, of being faithful, of being patient, and being selflessness, in the context of God's own great purpose with his creation. And give some thought also to your own controlled strength. So now I'd like to review some of the events in Moses' life to identify where these qualities become apparent, and perhaps more to the point, the ways in which they were developed. Moses was 80 years old when the commission came to him from God to lead his people Israel out of Egypt. The story of his birth and his early life is very well known to us. And we're familiar with the extraordinary way in which God overruled the dangers of his arrival into the world to give him an understanding and respect for God. From his earliest days, Moses knew about the promises to the patriarchs. He knew about sin, and he knew that there was a time in which God would fulfill his intention to take his people to himself, which was 400 years from when God spoke to Abraham. But now, the children of Israel were suffering cruel bondage to their Egyptian masters. They groaned day by day under the hard servitude imposed upon them, a very far cry from the hospitality and respect that they had enjoyed when the sons of Jacob went down into that country. Moses himself had enjoyed a privileged upbringing and position of honour in the court of Pharaoh. The record says that he was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in deeds and words. But for God, that wasn't quite enough. By now, he was a man of mixed loyalties. How could he reconcile his respect for the people of God as he did, and his responsibilities to Pharaoh? It could all have gone horribly wrong if God was not in control. In righteous anger, Moses became involved in two incidents in quick succession which showed up his lack of meekness. First, he killed an Egyptian who was smiting a Hebrew, and thinking he had not been seen, he hastily buried the man in the sand. The very next day, he came across two Hebrews striving together. And challenging them, he found that his murder of the Egyptian had become known. And he got the answer, "Who made thee a prince and a judge over us?" Let's remember that both Egypt, or the Egyptians, and the Israelites were under great stress at this time. But neither side were prepared for Moses to take the law into his own hands. What right did he have to do anything, either for the Israelites or the Egyptians? And it is, of course, a foolish man who becomes involved in any matter in which he has no business. So Moses fled into the wilderness. How far removed he was there for any possible opportunity to do what he felt he wanted to do. Consider his frustration. He was now a fugitive and a murderer. Instead of being a respected official, able to bridge the divide between Israel and Egypt, he was now obliged to change his occupation to that of a shepherd. No longer a resident in fine houses, he probably lived in a tent. What chance was there of him being able to do anything for God's people? And not only that, but the plan of God appeared to be delayed. That 400-year period of which he was aware had about 10 years to run when he went into the wilderness. So maybe he would have consoled himself with the thought that if he stayed there even for 10 years, then God's hand would become visible during that time. He was still there 30 years after the expiry of that period of time. So he was in the wilderness for half his lifetime before anything happened. If Moses found himself in the wilderness as a direct result of distinctly unmeek-like behaviour, then how thoroughly God ensured that his vainglorious attitude should be transformed. And at the same time, God knew that Moses had the potential for precisely the meek spirit which was necessary for the next stage. It took all those years in the wilderness. And we wonder whether there is anything to be learned from the fact that it required twice the length of his life thus far. Seemingly God held up the prophesied time period to achieve what was necessary. And meanwhile, remember, the bondage of the Israelites continued and increased. And somehow, that very different character that was formed in the wilderness was precisely what was required for the work of leading 2 million people out of the most powerful nation on the earth at that time. And I hope you won't mind if I read to you now just a few words from Brother Roberts in his book, The Ways of Providence, relating to this period of time in Moses' life. He wrote this in 1881, over 120 years ago. And I think it's remarkable, really, because it applies equally to our lives in the truth in 2012. And that's really why I'm quoting this passage. Like Moses, we are living at the end of a time of Israel's downtreading. Like him, we are looking for a promised divine interposition. Like him, we are able to discern providential signs characteristic of the situation. But like him, we have been the subjects of delay in our expectations. As in this case, we may see that notwithstanding adverse appearances, God is at work, and we may hope that like him we shall one day, and that soon, be rescued and cheered by the angelic intimation that the moment of open interference has at last arrived. When you consider the providential signs we see that he did not see, the impact, I think, of that should not be lost on us. The question is, do we want to be rescued and cheered, as he suggests? Life in Britain in the 1880s was tough for most people. Many of our community find it tough today, although not perhaps too tough in this country as yet. We live our lives amongst people who have no concept of biblical meekness. So for us, meekness in God's sight needs to be worked on. Suddenly, in Moses' life, the next stage arrived. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. We can find a lot of significance in that burning bush, but still I am sure Moses was not expecting to see it. He wasn't expecting to find his commission announced in such a way, if indeed he thought that he still had a role to play at all. Certainly by now he felt reticent rather than self-confident. But God had prepared this moment for a meek man to confront both a disbelieving Israel and a proud and uncooperative monarch over Egypt to set his people free. The release of Israel could have been achieved by dramatic and sudden upheavals in the natural world, as happened in the flood. But instead, it was this time by a slow and painful process that involved further suffering for God's people. But Moses understood. Pharaoh too had a role. "For this cause have I raised thee up, for to show in thee my power, and that my name might be declared in all the earth." That was Pharaoh's role as it was described to him. And his attitude served a purpose. The stage had been prepared for as many years as Moses had been in the wilderness for Pharaoh to be as he was. And by now Moses would understand that the seeming delay was not just for his benefit, but for the wider purpose of God as well. The debasement of Israel ensured that they were now ready for their release, and underlines a key principle. Brother Roberts puts it this way: Israel were made very distinctly to recognize that while they could do nothing if God was not with them, yet God could not, in a sense, do his part unless they did theirs. In no plainer way could the principle have been enunciated that God requires men to do their part as the condition and means of enabling him to work out his purpose with and concerning them. It is a principle illustrated throughout the entire course of Scripture, culminating in the command to work out our own salvation, coupled with the assurance that God works with and in us to will and to do his good pleasure. But if that was the case, and is obviously the situation, there was no way that Israel could rise up in revolt against the Egyptians, as they might have been persuaded to do when Moses was originally with them. Nor was God going to use the plagues to finish the Egyptians off. But there were things the Israelites could do, and that was to develop their own patience as they watched the repeated appeals of Moses to Pharaoh and the succession of plagues that came upon the country as a result of his intransigence. At length they were ready to leave, complying with the instructions to celebrate the Passover meal. At that time, all they thought about was getting away from that land of cruelty and slavery. They had seen the power of God in the plagues as God systematically attacked all the supposed power and religion and resources of that land, the symbolic representative of sin's power at that time. The devastation of Egypt and the passage through the Red Sea were to become legendary for decades to come, repeatedly celebrated in the Psalms and elsewhere, and also, of course, a clear type of the way that God will subdue this world when Jesus returns. And so to the wilderness. Here, if nothing else, Moses' patience was to be tried to the utmost. As soon as they left Egypt, he experienced a flavour of what was in store. It was here that he was challenged by Aaron and Miriam, as we read. Their faith wavered. As a people, Israel looked back. They blamed Moses, and 40 years like this were going to follow. But contrast them with Moses. We remember him for his steadfast strength, his love, his faith, his willingness to sacrifice himself for them, his zeal for the law, which he went bravely into the mountain to receive. But also we see his frustration that sometimes boiled over. The striking of the rock, the smashing of the tablets of stone. These are the incidents we know of. We also know about his weariness and how he was overwhelmed with the work that he was expected to do. But his message to the children of Israel was consistent. He encouraged them. He also rebuked them when necessary. But he always reminded them that God came first. God was the reason for everything they did. And only a meek man could put this across to them with sincerity and credibility. No one could accuse Moses of hypocrisy and double standards. And so the journey was nearly at an end. Let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 9. Deuteronomy chapter 9. Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 1. Hear, O Israel, thou art to pass over Jordan this day, to go in to possess nations greater and mightier than thyself, cities great and fenced up to heaven, a people great and tall, the children of the Anakims, whom thou knowest, and of whom thou hast heard say, who can stand before the children of Anak? Verse 4. Speak not thou in thine heart after that the Lord thy God hath cast them out from before thee, saying, for my righteousness the Lord hath brought me in to possess this land. But for the wickedness of these nations the Lord doth drive them out from before thee. Not for thy righteousness or for the uprightness of thine heart dost thou go to possess their land, but for the wickedness of these nations the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee, and that he may perform the word which the Lord sware unto thy fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Verse 24. Ye have been rebellious against the Lord from the day that I knew you. Thus I fell down before the Lord 40 days and 40 nights, as I fell down at the first, because the Lord had said he would destroy you. I prayed therefore unto the Lord and said, O Lord God, destroy not thy people and thine inheritance, which thou hast redeemed through thy greatness, which thou hast brought forth out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And verse 29, yet they are thy people and thine inheritance, which thou broughtest out by thy mighty power and by thy stretched out arm. What a different man Moses was by now. Even though he was not permitted to go into the land himself with them, we know that God will forgive him too. Otherwise, Hebrews chapter 11 would not be true. Moses' personal humility and meekness enabled him to be the forerunner of the great prophet that was yet to come. And here we're not thinking about the fulfillment of the ordinances of the law with their doctrinal significance, but his personal qualities, because that's really what this subject is all about. And nowhere is this more apparent than when we compare Moses to Jesus, who of course made none of the mistakes that Moses did. And for our final thoughts, we'd like to compare these two. Jesus, too, had a beginning in life that was similar in many respects to that of Moses. Born at a time when the ruling powers decreed the death of baby Hebrew boys. He was brought up in the knowledge of the true gospel. Jesus learned wisdom, and in the words of Cleopas, was a prophet mighty in deed and word before God and all the people. He too refused the dominion and crown promised to him during his temptation in the wilderness before he began his ministry. Now, obviously, Jesus wasn't in the wilderness as a consequence of some high-handed and misplaced action against the enemies of God's people, and nor was he there for as long. The 40 days he was in the wilderness condensed what Moses needed 40 years for. But the outcome was the same. Both of them came forth without any ambition at all to seek the riches of the present world, because they looked for one to come. But as Brother Thomas once wrote, thus far the resemblance between Moses and Jesus is complete. Cradled in peril, saved of God, and hopeful of the same promises, they were men of renown in word and deed, whose faith was made perfect by their works. But here, the similitude between them is suspended. They had, in other words, different missions in what came next, but they were both examples of meekness. Whereas Moses was once rejected, he was later accepted and revered by the nation as a whole. But Jesus has not yet been sent as a deliverer to the nation in the way that Moses had been. And consequently, the cry they uttered before his death has not yet been retracted, as it was for Moses. Away with such a fellow, they said, we will not have him reign over us. So that role of ruling over those people remains in the future for Jesus. Israel were more impatient with Jesus, which is why they rejected him when he did not do as they expected. They expected a prophet and a king who would do the equivalent of overthrowing their oppressors, that would build them a temple, that would organize the nation to take control of their land. But at that stage, 10 of the 12 tribes remained scattered abroad, and the other two, remaining in the land, were oppressed by the Roman powers. When Jesus came, a few recognized him as the fulfillment of the prophecies. As they said, we have found him of whom Moses in the law and the prophets did write, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. But most could not see it. They wanted, there and then, a conquering hero. And when Jesus was crucified, even those who had accepted him fled, and their hopes were dashed, they thought. But that is not the end of the story, as we know well. In the days of his ministry, Jesus performed a role that shows us what meekness is all about. Even Moses could not match it. In the days we live in, Jesus fulfills a different role. While we wait for his return to complete what Israel had mistakenly expected to happen at his first coming. And this gives us the opportunity to become Israel after the Spirit, to develop the qualities of meekness which we see in both Moses and Jesus. And if we do that, we will be fitted and prepared for the great events that we know are soon to take place upon the earth. So like the Israelites of old, we must make sure we are ready to leave the present spiritual land of slavery and go and celebrate the Passover. Brother Thomas wrote, Jesus, the great power of God, alone can accomplish this. It is the great work for which he has been prepared. A preparedness to which he has attained through suffering unto obedience and perfection. Moses suffered affliction before he was exalted to the throne of Israel. He was an abscondent homicide keeping sheep in the desert, a fugitive from his people, before he exchanged his crook for the scepter of Jeshurun's king. This is Jehovah's rule. Probation before exaltation. Israel's Messiah cannot be exempt from this law, a principle working out its results to this day in the experience of all who with him are the heirs of God. We might think that we cannot possibly aspire to the way that Moses achieved that meekness of character, which clearly he did, before he was ready to lead God's people. Our lives are so different, so insignificant compared to his. Our role in life is so different. But actually we can, because God wants us to be in his kingdom. God works out the same principles in our lives as he did in Moses' life, and in Jesus' life too. And that is preparation by whatever means is necessary in order to give us the inheritance that we believe can be ours. So our lives will follow the same rules. We can have true meekness, controlled strength. It is up to us to make sure that we accept that formula so that God truly can work with us.